This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Before Burt Reynolds became a movie star, he became a celebrity through his TV talk show appearances in the early 70s. As he says in his new autobiography, the talk show circuit changed his life. Merv Griffin liked him so much, he brought Reynolds back for 12 consecutive nights. I doubt Reynolds has done much public radio, so when he started his recent book tour, we invited him on. But this time around, things didn't go so well for Reynolds on the talk shows. He got into a series of contentious interviews, then cut short his book tour. Apparently, he went through a rough period as he wrote his new autobiography, Burt Reynolds, My Life. The book begins with his divorce from Lonnie Anderson and ends with him feeling profoundly shortchanged on the syndication rights to Evening Shade. When I spoke with him last month, I asked him what it was like to grow up the son of a sheriff in a small Florida town.
Well, it's like being a preacher's son or a sheriff's son or whatever. I mean, you go one of two ways. You're either a little angel or you're crazy. And I thought crazy was the best choice of the two. I was always in trouble, and I didn't want anybody to think that, because I happened to be the son of, that I could get away with things. And boy, he let me know right away that I didn't.
Did he punish you a lot when you were crazy?
Yes, I mean, he double punished. I mean, I was arrested once for fighting with about four guys, and they put us all in jail. And he came in and he said, your father's here, you can go home, your father's here, you can go home. Came to me and said, your father didn't show up. And I stayed there for four nights and threw every drunk he arrested on top of me. I was always doing something that wasn't... first of all, you have to understand that I don't respect anyone as much as I respect him. I never met a man in my life that I loved more. But he was the kind of a man that when he came in a room, all the oxygen left, except for whatever he breathed in. And he was 6 foot four, and he was a very imposing, strong willed man. And I spent most of my life, we have a saying in the South, no man is a man until his father tells him he is, and mine never did, which is why I was a little crazy until I was, until I had my son. Then I had to be an adult.
I want to ask you about one of your most acclaimed films, and I'm thinking of Deliverance.
You could almost say only acclaimed film, but I was only in... I think maybe two really acclaimed films, Deliverance and The Longest Yard, and maybe Starting Over because it was nominated for an Academy Award, the picture was. But Deliverance was an extraordinary film in the sense that it was these four actors. I don't think you could get four actors who would do what we did.
Well, you especially, you were almost killed.
Yes.
In a waterfall scene. Why don't you describe the scene, which apparently none of the stunt people even wanted to do?
No, they'd be said, you're too crazy. Go away, And I was crazy, but we could stop the water. We had a dam that we had control over, and it was a place called Tallulah Gorge, which Tallulah Bankhead actually was born near there and was named after this gorge, and it was about 85 feet down, and they sent a dummy over, Borman looked at it, John Borman, the director, and rightly so, said, it looks like a dummy. And I said to Borman, I can do that. And so they stopped the water, and I said, give me a spike, a mountain climbing spike. I went out in the middle of the river and drove the spike in. I put a rope around it, and I said, now when the water comes, it'll come around me, you see. And I'll put my hand up and wave, and that's when I'm going to let go, so you can roll the cameras. And then I'll go down there, I'll hit that rock, and then I'll spin off to the left, and then I'll do a flip, and then I'll land down there. And they all went right, We had about four cameras, and I heard them letting the water go. And I looked back, and coming at me was this tidal wave. And away I went, and I didn't go anywhere I told them I was going. I went wherever the water wanted me to go. But I the first rock I hit, my tailbone cracked. Then I did turn a flip, which was what I said I would do, but I didn't do it on purpose. Then I landed in what they call a hydrofoil. Well, a hydrofoil, you can't swim out of it. You have to swim to the bottom and then it kind of spits you out. And I had been told that, and I had remembered it, thank God. And I went to the bottom. What they don't tell you is that it spits you out like shooting a torpedo out of a submarine, about 70 miles an hour. And I went over the falls, a 30-some-year-old guy in the best shape of anybody, and came up 150 yards down the river, totally nude, and about 78 years of age, could hardly walk, and had hit every rock, you know, along the way, going 70 miles an hour, it seemed. And they all thought I had drowned. I mean, they said, there's a nude old man limping this way, but we've got to concentrate on getting Bert out of this hole, you know.
Well, what happened to all of your clothes? Were they shorn off by the rock?
They just vanished. I mean, that's how fast and how strong the water was. And the next day, I went to the rushes with everybody, very anxious to see my exciting stunt, and we looked at it, and I said to Borman, how's it look? And he said, like a dummy going over the falls.
Did it really look like that to you?
Not to me. It looked like a dummy, but a different kind.
Right.
But it was an extraordinary stunt to me.
Let me tell you what one of my favorite films of yours is, and it's a film that, unfortunately, I don't think many people saw. And I'm thinking of the 1989 film Breaking In that was directed by Bill Forsyth, in which you played an aging safecracker who takes on this young, arrogant, streetwise protege. I like that film a lot, and it was a pretty small film. You know, I imagine it's pretty small budget. Bill Forsyth's movies often play in art houses. How'd you get involved in that film? And I'm wondering what you thought of the film.
I liked the film, and I love Bill. And I'd loved his films before that. That was the first film he did in America.
He also did Local Hero.
Right. But Local Hero I'd seen four or five times and liked it more each time I saw it. Bill is Scottish and a wonderful man. Very kind man, and he came to Florida to see me and gave me the script, and I went home and read it, and I said, there's no part in here. I mean, why did you give me this? There's a young kid, and there's an old man. I mean, I can't play this young kid, and there's this old guy. And he said, I want you to play the old guy. And I said, you do? He said, yeah. And I said, well, with makeup? And he said, yes, I can't wait that long, you know. I can't wait till you're old. I mean, my God, I might be dead. So I was thrilled that he, you know, because it's casting with Bill. He sees something in you that he wants you, the essence of you in the picture.
Did you feel that film showed off a different side of you because it wasn't a celebrity-oriented film? It was a very small-scaled film.
Well, I thought it was a film that Pauline Kael would like because I had very little hair. And I'd probably get a good review because I was old and limping. But I thought that a lot of people would say, my God, he can act because he's old. It really was not as difficult as starting over. And, you know, it played at the New York Film Festival, and I got this incredible reception there. And I remember saying to the audience, I'm sorry I couldn't make it here the last time when Cannonball was here for the festival. But I was received very warmly. But it was you get credit for that. I remember my friend, a wonderful English actor who played a character in a film, and he had a hump on his back and bad teeth. And I said, you'll get nominated. And he was nominated. You know, you do that. If you have a growth on your back and a bad nose and a glass eye.
I'm going to stop you here because I don't think you're being fair to anybody. This wasn't a stunt performance. It was a nice character study. I don't think you're being fair to the critics who liked you, and I don't think you're being fair to your own performance.
I think I'm being very fair because I think it's true. I think that if you look at the performance that Dustin Hoffman gave with Tom Cruise. I'm sorry, Tom Cruise was brilliant in that picture. He was better than Dustin. If you want me to play a guy who's, you know, not all there, I can do it. You get more credit for that than you do when you're playing a part that's a leading man. You say I'm not being fair. I am being fair. I'm being fair to all the actors in the world who played leading men and never got credit for it, while a character actor came along, like Walter Brennan, who was brilliant, was nominated more times in history, won 5 Academy Awards. God, George, Jenny boy, can I have a drink now? And limped and limped and limped and limped and did all those things and got every Academy Award nomination. Well, John Wayne played John Wayne and never got any credit. And I'm sorry if you think that's unkind, but guess what? Everybody was more affected by John Wayne's death than any actor in history.
What are your favorite of your roles?
You're getting off this right away, aren't you?
Okay. No, I'm elaborating
on
it.
If you want to talk to an actor, you just say, talk about yourself, son, and they go right away from what
you're
talking
about. No, I'm elaborating this. I want to see what you think your best performances are.
My best performance was in Starting Over, because it was the most vulnerable part that I got to play.
This is a relationship movie in which you're left by your wife and then you start a new relationship.
Well, it was also a very difficult role to sell because my image, which you may or may not think is important, but it is. I mean, if your image, I don't think Errol Flynn could have done it. I don't think the public would have bought it. And I'm sorry to tell you that I had not much better in terms of PR at the time than Mr. Flynn did. And I was playing a man who was afraid to ask someone for a date, who was frightened by being suddenly single, who was a teacher, who was an educated man, who it was something that no one would have cast me in other than me. And I was number one in the box office at that time, and the director didn't want me, the producer didn't want me, and I tested for it 4 times.
It was one of those, who would believe this stud could play somebody who had a trouble asking someone for a date?
That's your word, not
mine. Is that basically what they were getting at?
I've never called myself a stud.
Okay.
I've never used that word. I find that word insulting.
Okay, sorry.
That's all right.
Who would think this hunk?
This hunk? Oh, you want to call me a hunk now?
Handsome celebrity. I'm just trying to get to the
Why
images.
Why is it that I can't defend myself, but you defend these these critics? I mean, if I don't want to be called a hunk, I find that sexist on your part, in reverse.
No, I'm just trying to get at the image that you're saying people had of you, so that you couldn't possibly.
The
play.
Image that people had of me was the image that Pauline Kael perpetuated, and a whole lot of other critics who said and quoted gossip columnists when they were reviewing a performance.
Uh-huh.
People don't review your performance. They review your life now. They don't review me. They review my life. This man who was in the centerfold, what the hell has that got to do with the movie that I'm in at the time? It should have nothing to do with it. If you're a good critic, you go into a movie and you say, I've never seen this actor before and I know nothing about this actor, if you're a true critic. The word critic is to critique. It's your performance, not your life. I don't want my life critiqued. I've done that.
I'm glad you brought that up because it strikes me that you and so many celebrities are in such a bind now. I mean, because your lives become so public that if a relationship goes bad afterwards, it becomes, a public feast. Everybody is kind of reading about what went wrong and everything. And I wonder if you think it's possible to be a celebrity in America anymore and survive the experience.
Of course it is. But you have to not be accessible. You have to be Robert Redford, who's Teflon. You have to be De Niro. You have to be Eastwood. You have to be very smart. If you're accessible, like I was and like I am to everybody, uh-huh. I've never, ever in my life, I've signed wet napkins and God knows what else all my life because I felt I like people in spite of some people. I like people. And if you are accessible and if you are making a lot of money and you're had a tremendous amount of success, what people do is if you are accessible, they are then given the assignment. It's called the envy barrier, of tearing you down because that's more interesting reading today. Nobody understands how hard it is to be an enormous success and still be a nice human being. It's very, very difficult because everybody teaches us what to do when we fail. Nobody teaches us what to do when we get successful.
I really appreciate what you're saying there. And that's what I meant before about how it seems like it's impossible to be a celebrity and survive the experience in America.
Yeah, and I told you that there's a whole bunch of people that have survived it very well by not being accessible.
Right, right.
And you didn't hear me.
No, I did hear you.
Then there's an answer to that, isn't there? You're not accessible and you're not nice. You just go to work and nobody knows your home address.
But someone like you, you said you felt you couldn't live that way, that's not you.
Well, I can't. But I also, by being accessible, you're accessible to pain, too. Mm-hmm. If you're going to have high highs, you're going to have low lows.
That's Burt Reynolds. He has a new autobiography called Burt Reynolds, My Life. This is Fresh Air.